Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And this is our first new show of the new year, so welcome to 2012.
Welcome to 2012.
And we're starting 2012 with a show on what I would say is conspiracies. Not necessarily the things you quite often read about, but pretty much this idea of conspiracy, this idea that somehow we are the victim or the active participant or whatever it is of a conspiracy which is sometimes of global proportions and sometimes even of galactic proportions. This idea that somehow millions of people, if not billions of people, are enslaved and therefore completely powerless, that they can't do anything whatsoever. That basically we should just watch television, go to work, eat, but not really do anything much more because there is this conspiracy. And when I say galactic conspiracy, the story sometimes stops at the president or them, people behind the scenes. And we have all seen this in so many movies and so many television shows. But the likes of David Icke and a few other people actually take it beyond the confines of this world. They take it into outer space. Even the likes of Zachariah Sitchin was one of those people. Basically, all of these people are saying that we are genetically engineered as a slave race and that somebody out there and out there literally beyond the confines of this planet is pulling the strings of the leaders of this planet and they are pulling our strings. And that has happened in the past, that is happening right now, and that this is something which is going to happen in the future until we do something about. But when you start to look into what this thing is, what we should be doing, we basically come to terms with the fact that there are really no, what I would say, easy solutions or even straightforward solutions. And we are going to talk about that as well. But let's start where this all started for us, which was a few weeks ago. In the run-up to Christmas, Kathleen was reading a book by Stephen King.
Yes, I was. And I'm going to apologize in advance at my... the older people in our audience, and by older I mean my age and above, because we have a lot of lovely younger people in our audience, will be familiar with an actress from the 70s named Brenda Vaccaro, and she was famous for, she had this very husky voice. And I'm having a little bit of a Brenda Vaccaro moment today, because I'm recovering from a post-holiday cold, which I've actually had for quite a while. And one of the things that got me through this cold during the holidays was this Stephen King book. I fell madly in love with a book by Stephen King, his newest novel, which is called 112263. And like many of you, we've had some of these discussions online and on Facebook. A lot of us who have been Stephen King fans in the past have had this sort of tumultuous relationship with that writer. For me, I became a huge Stephen King fan back in the days of The Stand. I think The Stand was his masterpiece. It's one of my favorite books of all time. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I loved Needful Things. And then I liked some of his other stuff. But then I went through a period where I found him unreadable. And I kind of strayed from the Stephen King fold. Then I was hearing about this new book he had coming out. And I was so fascinated by the subject matter that I had to give it a shot. And I'm so glad that I did. So for those of you who are not familiar with Stephen King's new bestseller, 112263, I think the title gives away that it has something to do with the Kennedy assassination. But the premise, which requires a certain amount of suspension of disbelief, but it's an easy thing to do in the hands of a masterful writer, which King is that there is a diner in Maine, and in the back of the diner is a pantry, and in that pantry is a portal into the past. Time travel. The book is about time travel. And basically what happens is, if you step into this pantry, you find yourself in this little town in Maine. It's always the same date. When you step back into time, you're always at a date in September in 1958. And no matter how long you are gone into that time frame, whether you stay for an hour or years, when you come back into the present, you've only been gone for 2 minutes. And so that is the premise of the book. And what happens is our hero, through a series of events, decides he's going to go back into time, into 1958, stay for 5 years, and stop the Kennedy assassination from happening. And therein lies the story, what happens to him on the run up to the assassination, and his plans to find Oswald, meet Oswald, go where Oswald is, and essentially stop Oswald from killing Kennedy. His belief is that if he stops Oswald from killing Kennedy and Kennedy survives, that a lot of the horrific things that happen next, including the casualties in Vietnam, will not occur and the world will be a better place. So this is the premise, and this is what fascinates me. Those of you who have been listening to us for a long time know that I have a real obsession with this idea of time travel and time slips. We've done a couple of shows on the time slip phenomenon. And so this was my bailiwick. I was excited about this book. And it, I have to tell you, it's one of the best books I've read in a long time. I could not put it down. I think I drove everyone in my family crazy during the holidays because I really had no interest in doing anything but reading the book. But I particularly drove my beloved Philip crazy. And here's why. Philip is an expert on the Kennedy assassination. It was really sort of the episode that brought him into this world of investigative journalism and conspiracy theory. And so when I would tell him about this book, he would sort of cover his ears and scream, because the premise of this book requires that you believe that Oswald was the lone assassin. The premise of the book is, if you go back in time to stop the Kennedy assassination, you're stopping Oswald from shooting him. Whether or not Oswald was a lone assassin didn't really matter to me, because... And I don't necessarily believe he is. I think some of the conspiracy information around the Kennedy assassination is so fascinating. But I was able to buy into it for the point of view of King's book, because his book was not really about Oswald being a lone assassin, even though you had to believe that for the book to work. The book was about what happens if you try to mess with the past. But for Philip to hear me buying into, even for the purposes of fiction, this idea that Oswald was the lone assassin was something that was really almost too much for him to bear. And as a result, I mean, the good news that came out of it is it really reawakened his passion and his interest for all things Kennedy. And it has caused him to go back and dig out some of his research from the past 20 years. And he's now going back, revisiting it, and he's putting together an ebook on all of his own discoveries about the Kennedy assassination. So I'm going to turn that over to you, and you can talk a little bit about how I made you crazy by even entertaining the idea that Oswald was the lone gunman. And ultimately, we're starting with this because it's sort of the very nature of conspiracy and where we go with it and what it does. And we'll move into how this is affecting all of us in 2012 in terms of this idea of grand conspiracy.
Yes, and two aspects to that. I mean, 20 years ago, I wrote a book which only ever made it as a manuscript, because I didn't really want it to continue beyond that. It was like my final say for myself as to what the Kennedy assassination was all about. And in the stampede of books which were published at that moment in time in the early 1990s, I knew that my book was never going to be up there with the likes of a Jim Mars Crossfire or all of the other books, because basically, you know, in the early 1990s, to get published on Kennedy assassination, it was the real deal. There were only so many publishers who were willing to do this, and they all had already authors in the field. So for about a decade, the book was printed out, laid in a comfortable cabinet in my home. Then the internet came about. I had my webpage. I decided to OCR it because the technology on which I had been typing this had far been outdated by that time. And then it sat on my webpage. And really, even though it was consultable, you could search for it. Really, there wasn't much interest. And now with the arrival of ebooks, really, it is so interesting to do these things. And it was actually great fun to go back. And specifically, the opening line of the prologue is about a Kennedy researcher who begins to look into this. He remembers his own ways of looking into the Kennedy assassination material. And as it so happens, my opening line of the book, which is going to be called Killing Kennedy, is really this researcher saying that he realized that all of this material was as interesting as any Stephen King novel. So it was an interesting twist of fate that I had begun that book 20 years ago, and that really the rekindling, because it will be available on Kindle as well, of this subject really happened because of Stephen King. But going back to the Kennedy assassination, I always say it is the moment in time when America began to lose its innocence. America for a very long period of time, and to some extent I still think today, has got this very warped view of itself. America is the greatest nation in the world. And the Kennedy assassination really began to etch away at these things. It began to realize that America was just like any other nation in the world. And every other country in the world had already realized that politicians were quite often corrupt, slept with certain people, and were doing nasty things. And specifically the press in America kept this from the general public. I've forgotten who it was. It might actually be Michael Moore. But there was this idea that Roosevelt, who was quite often bound to wheelchair, that people grew up with this quite often not knowing that he was a disabled person because the press didn't depict it. The press didn't specifically notice. And whoever this person was who went kind of reminiscing about his youth, basically identified this, that the press kept certain things out of the newspapers. And so with the Kennedy assassination, what you have is this extraordinary moment in time wherein an American president is killed. It's not unique. I believe 8 before of them or 7 before of them had been killed in office as well. It's not that specific to have an American president killed. But what happens is that a sequence of events rapidly unfolds. And what happens is, of course, Kennedy is killed. He is beloved. It's very graphic. What we have is footage which wouldn't be revealed for several years to come. But we have the reporter who immediately can go on the air and start reporting about this. And then, of course, they arrest the suspect, Lee Harvey Oswald. And then Oswald was the first, and if I'm not mistaken, still the only assassination ever to have been live broadcast on television. And basically what happens is that when Oswald is taken from the Dallas police headquarters to another location in the garage basement of the Dallas police headquarters, Jack Ruby, a local dance club owner, basically comes up to him and shoots him point blank, and Oswald dies. So everybody has seen this. And it leaves a gigantic question mark, because even though officially Oswald was never arraigned for the assassination of Kennedy, he was arraigned for the murder of a police officer a few hours after the Kennedy assassination. Basically, what happens is that there is this gigantic question mark, and everybody assumes that Oswald did it, but can we now prove it? And so what happens is the Warren Commission gets established, led by Chief Justice Earl Warren, and roughly a year later, about 10 months after the Kennedy assassination, they report back to then-President Johnson and say that Oswald is the lone assassin. And what happens is something which is so extraordinary, because here it becomes a matter of fate. For a very long period of time, about next 10 to 15 years, large sections of the American population believe the conclusions of the Warren Commission. However, various other people don't. And they managed to, in the 1970s, after I think America really loses its innocence with the Nixon Watergate scandal, to reopen so many dirty things from America's past. The Church Committee and various other things were looking at what the CIA had been doing, things like mind control techniques in which basically innocent people were subjected to various forms of medication and various other things to see what some of these drugs would have the effect on the human body. And so many things are happening. So many things are being exposed throughout the 1970s. And one of them is revisiting, by that moment in time, not just the Kennedy assassination, but also his brother Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. So all of these things in the 1970s go under the review. And really what comes out of this is, I think, an interesting concoction, the birth, really, of what I would say the conspiracy nation. First of all, the awareness that the American government is involved with conspiracies on its own soil, but also abroad. But I think from the 1980s onwards, the last 30 years, we have seen this escalation whereby really some Americans and some people across the world are now willing to believe everything. they are willing to believe the wildest conspiracies. So whereas, you know, I would definitely argue that Kennedy was assassinated as part of a conspiracy, what we have now are theories which suggest, for example, that Kennedy was killed because he was going to reveal the secret of UFOs. That Kennedy was killed for, you know, various other things. This idea, for example, that his driver, William Greer, a Secret Service agent, somehow turned around with a gun and then shot Kennedy in the face. Very hard to do, if only because there was Governor Connally sitting in between them and various other objects in between there. Obviously, there were hundreds of witnesses who would have been describing this. None of them ever described this. The person who aired this theory linked referred to the Zapruder film, whereby he allegedly saw this, when it was then pointed out that on the Zapruder film, Greer is not shown at all turning around with a gun. He made the claim that the Zapruder film was doctored. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this extraordinary claim is if you go onto the internet and you search for this specific claim by Bill Cooper in Behold the Pale Horse, what you'll find is that there are thousands of people who have taken this almost verbatim and are saying that this is really, you know, a deep insight because they somehow believe the credentials which Cooper came with, which was basically that he at some point worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence and that he had somehow seen these secret documents during his days with the Office of Naval Intelligence. So this is like the birth of the whistleblower. And when you start looking at things like UFOs specifically, but so many other things, you will find these extraordinary whistleblowers who will make extraordinary claims and they go completely unchallenged. But they are creating a worldview which basically is something which kind of like, you know, we have come to live in. And just after the new year, we basically sat down because people were saying, what do you think about Thrive? Because Thrive is very important. And so we sat down and we looked at it, and these are our conclusions.
Well, for those of you who are not aware of what Thrive is a documentary that came out on 11/11/11. That deals with this idea of conspiracy in a very big way. And that was a heavy sigh. I have a real love-hate thing with this conspiracy idea, and I'm really kind of schizophrenic on it, and I think that maybe that's healthy, because there is a part of me that says I cannot be so naive as to not understand that there are things going on in the highest levels of government and finance that would terrify us if we really knew the truth. But on the other hand, I think that there is a point where conspiracy is taken to such an extreme that it's just flat out fear-mongering. And it's also disempowering. And I think this is ultimately the point I want to get to as we talk about Thrive, is there's a really fine line between let's look at these possibilities and open our minds and start thinking about it and brainstorming about what we can do versus it's gone so far that you might as well give up. You're utterly powerless. You'll never be able to do anything about this. And so for me, you know, my favorite word, my word for 2012 is discernment. Discernment. We need to be discerning about all of the information that comes to us. And using Philip's example of this outrageous Kennedy conspiracy that his driver somehow shot him, even though everyone knows that it was impossible, and there's all kinds of film footage that shows that he didn't do that. In this age of tremendous information, overwhelming information, and fast information, what happens is if a theory or an idea catches on, you know, it's like playing this global game of telephone. All of a sudden, it becomes the truth. You know, the next thing you know, it's being presented as, oh, this happened. And this is where discernment comes in. When we start hearing conspiracies, I think it's really, really necessary for us to be discerning about where those conspiracies are going.
Well, and I think on a very basic level, specifically our American listeners will remember the Obama birth issue, which basically is, you know, a conspiracy from two corners. One of them is that somehow there is a conspiracy involving Obama and the fact that he is born in Kenya, not an American citizen, and therefore goes to extraordinary lengths to falsify this information, or that there is a conspiracy, whether purposely created or using this telephone system whereby people basically say, oh, well, you know, but there is some doubt as to whether or not he's born in Hawaii. We haven't seen this piece of information. And what I find extraordinary is the level of non-interest in large sections of the press to do any investigation. It's quite simple to do these things. For example, you know, the only thing they had to do was to go to the Hawaiian newspaper, look up the week when Obama was born, and they would find that there was an announcement of his birth, as so many newspapers still do and definitely were doing at that moment in time, specifically in states like Hawaii, which aren't that you know, populous as the million inhabitant cities like New York or Los Angeles. So what you have is clear, easy accessible material, but somehow America got caught up in this issue. It influenced politics. It headlined specifically Fox News for, of course, all its interesting reasons. But it is a conspiracy theory, and you know, it's something which is easily provable or disprovable, but somehow it begins to lead a life of its own, and it takes away things. It really is evidence, I think, of the disempowerment of government for however weeks or however many months it was. And then, of course, when Trump comes to play his card, he used this as his campaign strategy, and it really was interesting to see how a man like Trump, I think, legitimately seemed to be convinced that this was something he could play with, because otherwise he would have realized that his presidential campaign was going to last anywhere from a few days to a few weeks. There was simply no way Trump would ever become a electable presidential candidate with, you know, months to go through presidential campaigning to get a nomination for the Republicans or even run as an independent with this kind of material. Yet he seemed, in my opinion at least, absolutely convinced that what he was doing was, you know, this absolute belief in a conspiracy theory. And basically, you know, Trump is therefore an example of a conspiracy believer at a very high level, because it kind of like has reached the levels of, well, he's not a government official, but definitely somebody running for president.
So let's get back to Thrive here. So we had a lot of people who we love and respect in our personal world saying, oh my gosh, you've got to watch this movie. It will blow your mind. Lots of people on Facebook posting us, oh my gosh, here's the link. You got to watch this movie. It's unbelievable. Now, I avoided it for months because for one simple fact, and that was because David Icke was in it. And I am not a fan of the all people in power are lizard people theory that David Icke has made quite popular. And so for me, as soon as you include David Icke into any kind of conspiracy film, I'm done. I'm out. I'm just not going to go there. But I will say he's edited beautifully in this film. And actually, if you didn't know that he believes everyone from Jesus to the Queen is a lizard person, you wouldn't know that from watching this film. The elements of David Icke in this film are actually quite powerful. He's an interesting character because he's quite compelling when you see him on screen, you know, and I think that's why he's come so far in his in this world that we're in, because he comes off as so credible, and so much of what he says makes real sense. It's just when you dig into, you know, the expanded versions of his theories that it goes off into a land where I do not want to travel. So we avoided it. And then so many people kept saying, you have to. We realized that we were being actually irresponsible in not watching the whole thing, sitting down and really making a comment on it. And it was funny because in the first, I would say, 30 to 40 minutes of the movie, I kept looking at Philip and thinking and saying, maybe we were wrong. Maybe this really is a good thing. Because the early parts of the film, I think, are thought-provoking, but also inspiring, you know, not scary, you know, but definitely interesting. And there's a lot of great information, and Foster Gamble presents his case in a very compelling way. But then it's like this sort of dangerous seduction. It starts pulling you deeper and deeper into it. And then before you even realize you're there, you are in the quicksand mire of the hardball conspiracy theory. And by the end of it, you are utterly powerless. And that is the thing that makes me upset about films like this. I think this film set out to be something that could have been inspiring and thought-provoking, and instead it devolves into this mass of fear-mongering. And that's the piece of it that, for me, is upsetting and negative and maybe worse. You know, maybe there is something even, you know, more... there's something uglier for me going on at the surface. And the touchstone for me is this: how do I feel at the end of it? At the end of this movie, do you feel like an activist? Do you feel like, I'm going to go out and do something? I'm going to, you know, and it plays the game with you. It says, here's this thing, here are the things that you can do, you know, in your own life, but at the same time hitting you over the head with, and here's all the reasons why that won't work, because you're utterly powerless, because basically the Rothschilds and the banks own everything and they control you and you're done. I was so depressed at the end of this movie. I felt utterly disempowered. Let me tell you something. I'm an Aries. I'm an activist. And to make me feel disempowered is no mean feat. So I felt that any movie that ultimately takes someone who is an activist and who works from a place of positive inspiration and turn that into a place of defeat is not a good thing. This was not an inspirational film for me. It did not blow my mind in a way that, you know, made me go, oh my gosh, I now know the truth and I've got to go out and do something about it. It felt like fear-mongering to me. It went too far. It started out as something I think was really, really interesting and just turned into something that was just really murky and muddy. And it's fear-mongering, and that's what conspiracy theorism is at its worst. It's fear-mongering. At its best, it's thought-provoking. And this is where the discernment comes in. We've got to be discerning about the information that's sent to us and see where it takes us.
Yes, and I mean, to just go back to the premise of Thrive, it is that life, you know, on this planet is somehow destined to thrive. It, to some extent, is a theory of evolution, I think, of, like, you know, diversity, happiness, and basically the premise of this movie, which they try to underpin with some science, is basically that this is what, you know, it's all about: thriving, being happy, living happy lives, and all of that stuff. But then, you know, we are confronted with a fact and a reality that we live within reality. You know, certain things which we would like to do, for example, right now, would like to be sitting on a beach, you know, even though there is a beach only like 20 miles away from here and it's probably sunny there, I can't just click my fingers and go there. This is a very straightforward reality. And for some other things, higher ambitions, higher dreams, higher challenges we want to have, you know, whether it is world peace, which is so often quoted on the various pageants by, you know, the pageant people there, it just doesn't happen. And there are reasons for that. And so what are these reasons? And basically, Thrive is saying that the reasons why all of these things aren't happening is because we are basically shackled by this group, by this powerful elite. And it is a matter of fact that, you know, there are extremely rich people out there and that there are extremely big corporations out there. To some extent, they employ us. To some extent, they feed us. To some extent, they provide us with electricity and the basic means. So, you know, they are not necessarily totally evil. But at the same time, they do have a way of controlling us. Sometimes through no conspiracy whatsoever. For example, if the electrical grid goes down, we will not pay these companies, but we also will not have an electricity. So by default, like, I would say there is this passive control there. But all of these things kind of, like, you know, really don't touch upon what Thrive is about. What they are then saying is all of these people, all of these corporations are working together for basically, you know, purposes where we can't do anything about and which are completely against us. And to some extent, I would say that in a number of occasions, there are definitely companies out there who are only interested in seeing more profit and not giving anything whatsoever to their employees or the people who are actually relying upon them. To a large extent, I think history has always also shown that these things have a way of going out of business, either through the people, or by simply a competitor coming aboard. You know, this idea that as soon as a business loses interest in its customer, it's something which you know, is a valuable lesson. And it's to a large extent also the thing to do with countries. If countries lose the best interests of the citizen, it might take years before it happens. But I always go back to this idea, and for the second time today, I don't know who it is, but that there was a historian who basically said that the Roman Empire's power as an empire was finished roughly 150 to 200 years before it actually fell. And the reason was that everybody was still living under the assumption that if they rebelled against the emperor, they would be squashed down and dead, and that they were completely powerless. And it took 150 to 200 years before everybody in the world realized that the emperor was naked, that he was powerless. And that's when the moment in time the Roman Empire fell. And so all of these things, you know, have a natural way of going about these things. But again, Thrive is saying that all of these things are happening to a large extent, that we can't do anything about it. But what we should do is go and meditate quietly in our corner. It's this passive resistance. And what I hated about it was specifically that they keep using the imagery of Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Towards the end of the movie, they constantly are telling us that these are the people we should be looking up to, because these are the people who apparently are the only ones who've ever revolved against anything, and that, you know, really they are the ones who we should take our example at. Well, to a large extent, Martin Luther King and Gandhi were indeed very powerful and inspirational people, but the revolt they were trying to bring about was A, different from the revolt which Strife is talking about, and B, as much as I love both Gandhi and Martin Luther King, it wasn't a total success. And also, they weren't alone. And to a large extent, I think Martin Luther King's means of going about it definitely wasn't passive.
No, I mean, Martin Luther King, we're actually recording this on Martin Luther King's celebration day, and I actually just quoted him on my Facebook page, and one of my favorite King quotes is that rioting is the speech of the unheard. You know, this is a man who talked about resistance and talked about it in a very strong way. So I'm a huge King fan, but he was not always passive, and it's a mistake to think that he was. This is not me advocating for violence. I am just saying that... again, this comes to this whole idea of discernment. You know, what are they telling us to do in this movie? Are they're telling us to do nothing in a lot of ways. I get it. You know, I'm a spiritual girl. The show's called The Spirit Revolution, and this idea of we have to change ourselves first if we're going to change the world, be the change we should see in the world, and all of that. But there's a lie down element to the message of Thrive at the end. Because it's your only option, that I found disturbing. And the other thing I want to talk about in Thrive is this goes back to this idea of discernment when we're given information. So we're intaking all this information that they're giving us in this movie, and we are intaking it on faith. Everything that they're telling us is true. But when you start doing the truth autopsy, which is something that Philip and I are fond of doing with books and documentaries, and you start pulling it apart, you start seeing that there's some really big holes in their case. And I don't like being manipulated. I don't like someone telling me an exaggerated or a false story in order to get me to believe something. This happens in Thrive in the case of Nikola Tesla. Now, I am a big Tesla fan, as is Philip. We have both been fans of Tesla and have read about his life and his work for many, many years. And Thrive uses the event of Tesla's persecution in a very powerful way, but not in an entirely honest way. So whereas I agree that Tesla was definitely persecuted and some terrible things happened to him as a result of the fact that he did embrace free energy and it was something that he cared a lot about, the way that it's presented in Thrive is simply not factual.
Indeed, and it is this, we all know that Tesla was working for JP Morgan, and they're trying to point out that basically Morgan shut down Tesla's laboratory, which is fact. But what they're saying in Thrive is basically this, that somehow JP Morgan finds out that Tesla is working on free energy. And that when Morgan finds out, you know, then there is a mysterious fire in Tesla's laboratory, and that this is the end of the free energy research which Tesla was doing. Well, first of all, Morgan found out that Tesla was doing free energy work from Tesla himself. Tesla basically came to JP Morgan and said, I know I'm working on this bit for you, but I would also be like to work on this bit for you. Morgan said, I need more money. Tesla said to Morgan, I need more money to do this. Morgan said, well, what is the outcome of this? And Tesla basically said, well, I will be able to give free energy to America, if not the world. To which Morgan basically said, that's not in my interest. And so he stopped funding Tesla. As a result of this, within the next year to 18 months, Tesla didn't find any other investors and had to lay off people. And basically, his laboratory didn't burn down. It simply became void of employees because basically the line which Tesla wanted to pursue hadn't found investors. Now, this is sad, but it is not at all the way Thrive is depicting it.
And this becomes the ultimate issue for me with Thrive and with other sort of conspiracy-based theory movies, books, etc. Be honest with me. Once I know that you have not been honest with me, you've lost me. I need to know that the information that you're presenting to me makes sense. And I will go with you. I will go with you into your conspiracy theory if I can ascertain that everything that you're telling me is the truth. But from the minute I realize I'm being manipulated into believing a certain thing, you know, that's when I'm going to have a credibility issue. And in terms of Thrive and the Tesla thing, that's exactly what happened. Is what happened between Tesla and JP Morgan a tragedy? Completely. But it's a byproduct of capitalism in the early 20th century. It was a business decision by Morgan. You know, he wasn't an altruist. You know, he was not there to do philanthropic things. I wish he would have been, but he wasn't. And therefore, what happens between Tesla and JP Morgan is not, there's no skullduggery involved. And that's what Thrive tries to make it all secretive. Nobody knows how this happened, but it must have been the Illuminati. You know, no, it really wasn't. It was a business decision. It was a tragic one. Ultimately, what happens to Tesla is terrible, but there's really no secrets behind it. And so, again, you know, before you get too pulled into these massive conspiracy theories, just think about, you know, the information and start doing your own research. There's no reason why you can't do your own truth autopsies. When you start getting these bits of information, do some digging and see what you find out and make those conclusions for yourself. You know, there is a revolution that needs to happen here, and we're seeing it with the Occupy movement or what was the Occupy movement. And we're at least seeing people starting to stand up and say something is really wrong in America and it needs to be fixed. And I don't know where it's taking us, but I do know that we are not powerless. And that, you know, it's 2012, there's something so interesting happening in 2012, because I do believe that there is an energetic to the time period that we're in, whatever that looks like. There is... Everyone, if you think about what's happening in your own life and you look at the people around you and you read the comments on Facebook and read the blogs that are out there in the world right now, everyone is feeling it. Everyone is feeling this surge toward change. The center cannot hold. Things can't go on the way that they are. And we are in a time of change, but it should be exciting. It should be motivating. It should be something that we are inspired to do. And we should not be coming to it from a place of fear. Here is my touchstone for everything. If whatever information I am reading, listening to, or watching comes from a place of fear or makes me feel like I am in a place of fear, it must go. It cannot be considered. It has to get out. Anything that does not make you feel like you have some power in your own life and in your own world is, in my opinion, unhealthy and should not be considered.
And of course, Time made 2011 the person of the year 2011, the protester. And it started in Egypt and it continued all the way through the summer into the Occupy movement. And I remember a political commentator saying, you know, this Arab Spring it's something which is happening, but will it come to the Western world? And the answer was, yes, it came. And it was an act of suppression of the authorities to basically say, we have laws and we're going to use them, and we are going to trick some of these people into stepping on streets so that we can arrest them. And basically any trick in the book was used to stop the Occupy movement. But when I looked at the fact that the Occupy movement, you know, let's look at what happened in Cairo. You have a few hundred people growing into, on occasion, a few thousands of people in Tahrir Square at the center of Cairo. The same thing happened in cities and towns across the Western world. I visited one in Amsterdam, which was basically as close to the royal residence as you could get. In fact, it was closer to that residence than anything happening in Tahrir Square from Mubarak's residence. All of these things were happening in both Arab world, other worlds, and the Western world. But why did the revolt happen there and it didn't happen here? And I think the answer to some extent lies in the fear factor. And the one thing is this, the Occupy movement used V for Vendetta as this image, the mask of V, you know, who has been scarred, who does all of these things for vengeance and revenge and anything else with a V. And it is his personal vendetta. And this young, innocent girl, Evie, played by Natalie Portman, realizes that there are certain things wrong. She realizes that some of the people she works with are lying to the general population, and she realizes that the government really isn't what it is, and what it pretends to be. And she wants to do something about it, and she becomes V's accomplice, really without realizing why. But she becomes, and there is one very important thing, which is that Evie basically is locked up, imprisoned by V, because he says you need to be fearless. As long as you have fear, you will not be able to do what I have done and what I am doing. And fear is the factor which, you know, stops certain things from happening. People in Tahrir Square are 20, 25 years old, but they had no future. They were absolutely convinced that there was no future for them. People in the Western world still feel that they have a future. The grievance towards the governments in the Western world is not as strong as the grievance which existed in the Arab world. And that is, I think, one of the determining factors as to why the Occupy movement, you know, to some extent failed, and why it didn't have the same results as they were in the Arab world, because some of the people in the Occupy movement absolutely felt that this was going to bring about real change, and it hasn't. But so I think fear there is another factor, to start using the F words. But there is also something else, I think, going on in 2012, and I think 2012, is the year of a presidential campaign. And as I said before, we have seen how Trump got the conspiracy factor in there with the Obama birth certificate, whether it was Hawaii, Kenya, or anywhere else. There are several movies and a new History 2 documentary called America's Book of Secrets, which is basically based on a number of movies. And this notion that the president knows everything. And it is very interesting to see, because there are really two strands of conspiracy theories. In one strand, the president doesn't know anything. He is a puppet who doesn't know anything, who is played with, or by rather, unknown forces who pull his strings, who basically use him as a facade to talk, and he is unaware of anything. For example, this is the Cooper thing, that Kennedy had no idea whatsoever that there were UFOs. Bill Clinton, at one point in the 1990s during his presidency, was asked whether he knew anything about Roswell, and he basically went on the record as saying that he had asked some of his people, I believe an undersecretary of state, if I'm not mistaken, to look into this, or it might have been justice. And basically the person came back and said that wherever he looked within the government, he hit upon a blank wall that nobody was giving him answers. And so what happened was that Bill Clinton pretty much went on the record saying that, you know, he wanted to know the truth about Roswell, but that he had no idea, and to some extent validated the fact that there was a cover-up involving Roswell. So this is the one aspect in which the president doesn't know anything. And quite often this turns out to be a Democratic president. The Republicans are quite often given the label that they are actively aware. And I think to a large extent this is to do with Nixon and Watergate. I think very much it can be traced to that. But, you know, it leads to two conspiracy theories which shift every 4 to 8 years, whereby the president doesn't know anything to the president knows everything. And as I said, movies like The Rock, movies like movies like National Treasure really go into this thing and say that there are documents, whether they are belonging to Hoover's private collection or to a presidential book of secrets somehow hidden in the Library of Congress or anywhere else, whereby basically as soon as you become a president, you can go into this book and find out all the secrets about your predecessors, and also I assume you're being invited to add to them. It's almost like a diary, this idea that a president conscience needs to be alleviated, and as a result of that he will write down all of these secrets in a book of secrets which only the president will see. And again, it is two different strands in which one of them we see the president as completely disempowered, whereby democracy is completely futile. Or that all of, you know, that democracy is great until it hits the top echelon of the White House, and then we are led to believe, it seems, that every president becomes so disillusioned with reality that he simply gives up and says, "Oh, I can't do anything about it. Look what all of my predecessors have done," and literally all of my predecessors have done, and seems to change tack. And I definitely think this is something which is going on in America at this moment in time, because Obama promised great change, pretty much hasn't delivered anything. And I believe you were reading articles and basically saying, you know, like, what is next? Because we're at a crossroads in America, in the sense that Obama is going to be reelected unless a miracle happens within the Republican Party. And then there is this hope that the Obama for the next 4 years is going to be a radically different person than the Obama which we have seen the last 4 years, and that to some extent the Obama which we're going to see was the Obama we thought or hoped we were going to see.
Yeah, that's a double-edged sword for a lot of us. You know, it's so tricky because, you know, the right wing is so terrifying and so fringy. And any candidate from the Republican Party is just not to be dealt with, in my opinion, for so many really basic reasons. And a lot of my reasoning comes from being a strong female activist, that there is just nothing in the Republican Party there for me, or for women like me. And however, in 2008, I was one of those people who worked very, very hard to see Barack Obama in office. I was a big fan of hope and a big fan of change. And, you know, this community that I live in here in Los Angeles, I mean, I watched it come together, this diverse and often disparate community, come together in this idea that, you know, we could get this man in office and make real change and improvement in our world. And the things that we did to get that man in office, I mean, we did everything from write songs to hold bake sales. I mean, there was a bake sale one day in Hollywood where they raised like $10,000 in a couple of hours. I mean, this is the kind of excitement and money and passion that people were feeling around this idea of hope and change. And what I've ultimately come to realize over the last 4 years of disappointment in this man is that we weren't voting for a man, we were voting for an ideal. We were voting for an ideal that we so desperately wanted to believe could happen. And we believed that this man could be the leader who could bring that ideal to us, because he told us that he would, you know? And he stood up for it, and we were there with him. And honestly, he has done almost nothing that he said he would do. And in fact, he has done things that are entirely counter to what he said he would do. And there are times, and you know, in our private moments here, where I will look at you and I say, you know, did he dupe us completely? You know, and this is where I become plagued by the conspiracy. You know, this is when I start listening to the conspiracy theory. Say, is he evil? You know, did he sucker us all into believing that he was the, you know, the true harbinger of change and goodness? And is he really the opposite? You know, or is it strictly one of those situations that he got into office and, you know, he had so much opposition with the Republican Party and you know, stopping Obama and disagreeing with Obama and making Obama look bad at any cost has really been the nature of the last 4 years. And I certainly hear all of that. But even, you know, it's like this recent bill that he signed, you know, into law, that basically deprives us of all of our rights if the American government chooses to, you know, lock you up for any reason. For security reasons, that you don't have any right to a trial and you don't have any right to representation. I mean, those kinds of laws are really, really scary. And Obama signed that bill. He signed it. And even though he said he was signing it under duress or he didn't agree with it or he was disappointed that he had to sign it, the fact is he still signed it. And he, as a man, as a human being, and as a politician, has the ability to stand up and say, I'm not going to sign it. I am not going to sign it. If you're going to find a way to pass this by working around me, so be it. But I am going to stand for something right now and say, this is not okay. This is not what America is about. This is not constitutional. It's not humane. It's not ethical. It's not moral. I want to see him just once stand up and be that man that we thought he was in 2008. And I don't think he is. And that's a really hard thing for me to say because I worked very, very hard to, you know, as so many millions of people in this country did, in hopes that he would be and that he would get there. So I don't know what it means for 2012 because I'm going to have to vote for him because I will not vote for a Republican. And yet, it's a harsh one for me. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to this country. It's the reason I spent a lot more time in France.
And I think to a large extent, an awful lot of what is happening is, and I think to some extent this is also what is happening to Obama, is this continuous picking at you. It's like constant poking in the back. And then you forget that you can actually stand for something. It wears people out. One of the factors as to why people are quite often disappointed within a corporate lifestyle is because the corporate environment will basically break your spine. And I think to a large extent over the last 4 years, this has also happened to Obama. If he ever stood for something, they've basically, you know, put that spine out of action and he just goes with the motions. And so I think this is bringing it back to the spirit revolution. I think the call for action for everybody is to really, you know, realize that you are an individual, that you are a powerful entity, that you can bring about change. The change doesn't necessarily have to happen, you know, you do not have to be a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King and speak to thousands and rally, but basically speak your truth. You know, speak your opinion. Don't just go with the flow as so many people are doing. And I think this is, you know, I wouldn't call it evil, but as a description, I think the evil of our times is to say, oh, well, we are powerless. Look, so we just do this. No, if we decide not to do just whatever we think is the easiest way out, but if we do what we think is right, I think that is really the right way of going about these things. To say, no, I have an opinion and I'm willing to voice it. And that, I think, is really what is needed today. I think that is really, you know, the big problem of today's Western society. This idea that somehow there are forces out there which are trying to keep us quiet. And if we speak out, it will somehow not matter. I think that is simply not true. If you do speak out, it does matter. People will listen to you. And what's more, people will actually agree with you. They will say, funny, I've always believed that as well. Or, yeah, I'm exactly of the same opinion. And, you know, if you can do it in a discerning way, whereby you don't antagonize everybody straight away, you will go a long way into bringing about real change. And I'm not talking here about everybody starting a revolution, which is somehow, going to topple governments. It is basically, a movement, I think, whereby people are saying, hey, we can talk about these things. I can talk about these things with friends. There is this notion out there. We do not have to conform to these things. And on a completely, separate level, this is to some extent my experience with Ancient Aliens. For decades, people felt that this was a topic which there was nobody else in the world about. They couldn't talk about this. There was, no way anybody else was going to be interested in this as well. And now all of a sudden, without any change, I mean, the world on this field hasn't changed in the last 40 years. But what happened when Ancient Aliens was aired on television, people felt that they had the liberty to talk about this. People could say, hey, did you see that thing on television yesterday? And a conversation happened. Whereas before, people would have said, like, hey, I've been reading Eric von Däniken's book on this. What do you think about this? And somehow that difference of saying, hey, I have done something, what is your opinion about this, is very hard for people. Whereas if they can introduce a subject by saying, hey, did you see it on television, or did you read it in a newspaper, or anything like that, is an easier opening. But nothing has changed on this topic. It's just that we felt that there was this active suppression of this information. Somehow we felt that this was a taboo subject which nobody could talk about. Everybody could always talk about these things. It is just that the climate in which it was spoken about has changed in the last 40 years. And really, this was simply because very few people in Hollywood decided that it might be of interest for some people, to make this series. And nobody thought it was going to be a success, but just someone felt that this was the right thing based on their experience and brought about change. And this is just one example of so many things, but it is one example of something which I have experienced, from very close. And basically what I'm saying is this, is if everybody finds a means to speak about what you believe in, if what you stand for, what you want to talk about, it's not that hard. Just give it a go. You will not be shut down at all.
Well, the same is true in the world of religion. I mean, 10 years ago, we couldn't talk about Jesus being married. Publishers would not consider books about Jesus being married. I know, because I approached them. And that is the uplift here, is that we are living in a time where we can talk about it. We can have discussions online, on Facebook, in the blogosphere, on television. We can talk about all of these subjects in ways that we have never been able to do it before. And we are not going to be burned at the stake. Although I do think that a lot of us still carry that. And I do. I think a lot of the fear comes through us from our DNA, our soul memory, whatever it is. I think that there is an element of us that is still afraid to speak out. I hear this from women a lot on my Facebook and in my discussion groups, that they carry something within them that comes from being a strong woman, or an opinionated woman, or a woman who has a secret that wants to be discussed. Speaking that out causes death and destruction. And I definitely think that a lot of us still sort of carry that in our cells, or in our, ancestral memory or spiritual memory. And I think it's something that we have to work through. But the good news is what 2012 brings more than ever is this openness. And we can have these dialogues, we can express these things without the fear of being burned at the stake or overt persecution. Overall. I'm a little worried about this bill Obama signed into effect. But other than that, I think it's a very, very positive time for self-expression.
And so with this, we have come to the end of the first show of 2012. If you want to listen to all of our shows of 2010 or 2011, you can do so on the BBS Radio Archives. You will be charged a small fee because you cannot just listen to us, but to hundreds of other interviews which have all aired on BBS Radio. For that, you need to go to bbsradio.com. You can always listen to the last 5 episodes of The Spirit Revolution on our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. You can also go to iTunes, where you have about a year and a half of information, all of our shows downloadable for free. You can also visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/spiritrevolution, and you will be able to listen to some of our shows there as well. But until the next time,
the truth against the world.